Hello, hello. This is Colin. Welcome back from a weekend. I hope you got some rest. I hope you were diverted from some of the quandaries that face us. But we are going to jump right back into those quandaries. So, you know, if you were quandary-free for 48 hours, congratulations. We're going to begin with political quandaries, governmental quandaries, the future of democracy quandaries. And then, as is our want, as is our custom, in the second half of our Monday show, we will spend a bit of time looking at biomedical quandaries, COVID-19 quandaries, vaccination rollout quandaries. And of course, these are all stitched together somehow, too. It's impossible to take one out of the other. Anyway, do I sound like I didn't get enough rest this weekend? I think that might be the case. Anyway, joining us now, as he has several times before, always to our great pleasure, is Yasha Munk, the founder and editor-in-chief of the journal Persuasion, an associate professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University, and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. His latest book is The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Welcome back, Yasha.
Thanks, Colin. That's a lot of quandaries we're talking about today.
Yeah, many quandaries. But I think I might have just overloaded the quandary.
It's a quandary about how many quandaries to talk about.
Exactly. So I maybe just begin with a piece that dropped this morning about in which you cite, I think it dropped this morning, I have no idea, but in which you cite the idea of political commentators who were kind of never Trumpers the last time around. These would be your sort of Ben Shapiro type conservative political commentators who are now, oddly enough, even as the tide seems to be flowing pretty hard away from Trump, they are actually coming sort of back to a fold they never were in the first place, and exercising what Rich Lowry in the National Review called the only available middle finger, which is voting for Trump as a way of what? As a way of rejecting what they see as excesses on the left. So tell us more.
Yeah, so as you're saying, the polls seem to indicate that there's a lot of Americans who gave Donald Trump the benefit of a doubt in 2016, perhaps weren't huge fans of him, but thought that let's give him a try and see what happens. Who have now become convinced that that is a very bad idea, and that they should embrace Joe Biden. And so, if the polls are to be believed, Joe Biden is quite clearly ahead. But there is an interesting set of commentators. Some of them, longtime conservatives like Ben Shapiro. Some of them who actually have their roots more in the sort of liberal left, like James Lindsay. Who have decided that actually now is the time to embrace Trump, because he is the only person, according to them, who stands up against the sort of illiberal excesses on parts of the left. So I wrote an article that did drop this morning at The Atlantic, which basically argues a couple of things. First, that there are, in fact, liberal excesses on parts of the left, but worries that some people, not just those two I mentioned, but others as well, have about, for example, some Democratic politicians not being sufficiently upfront in taking on the far fringes of the left, not being willing, for example, to criticize unambiguously violence at certain protests, organizations like Antifa, that there is something to worry about there. But there's also something to worry about in the calls for censorship on social media, in the criticisms of free speech on the left. That there's some Democratic politicians, like the front runner to be the next mayor of Portland, Oregon, who go around with items of clothing that seem to celebrate Che Guevara and Mao Zedong, and that's something that we really shouldn't be celebrating. So I think it's not crazy to say that there are legitimate reasons to be worried about some of those developments on the left. That's the first point I make. But the second point I make, and the more important one, is that it's really a huge mistake to think that voting for Donald Trump is going to contain that rising illiberalism, that to vote for Donald Trump because you're worried about those attacks on our longstanding constitutional values or attacks on key institutions of the United States is really to cut off your nose to spite your face. And that's the case for two straightforward reasons. The first is that Donald Trump himself is a very clear and present danger to those values. And the second is that he's actually, paradoxically, the biggest ally of left-wing extremists, because it is only as long as Trump is in office that some of what they say and argue can seem plausible. That many Americans, for example, might say, look, we don't like political violence, but perhaps we shouldn't criticize people on our own side because, you know, really the biggest danger right now is Donald Trump. So let's shut up and sort of let them do their thing. I think all of that will hopefully end when the danger of Donald Trump is banished and when, you know, a moderate politician like Joe Biden is in the White House.
Yeah, so I just I agree more than I disagree with the premise, but let's talk through it a little bit more, too. I mean, I think both you and I have felt at different times over-policed by people who really need to cross every T and dot every I of wokeism. And so, yes, you've got that. On the other hand, I think the news media, and I suppose the electorate a little bit, is struggling also with that notion that there was sort of a false symmetry invoked in 2016. And as we look at it now, we're worried that if we say, oh, yeah, well, there's the Proud Boys and those kinds of movements, but there's also Antifa, that we're engaging in symmetry that doesn't really exist symmetrically, that on the one hand, you have a president who's unwilling to denounce any of these movements and movements that are organized and active and has to have chapters and indoctrination processes and stuff like that, versus Antifa, which, you know, Biden, no Democrat that I'm aware of, endorses it. I mean, there's the question is almost this sort of Aquinian scholastic question. To what degree does it exist? Is it a real thing? Is it a bunch of people who kind of share some values and show up at some things? And so, you know, when you look at some of the questions that way, the argument is, well, yeah, everybody should be clear about denouncing whatever excesses and violence Antifa engages in, but do we have to do it in a way that's symmetrical?
Well, I think that that's a false choice that you're positing there. You can absolutely say that you know, the danger is bigger on one side than the other, and perhaps even that what's motivating and driving people is worse on one side than the other. I believe that. That's why I make this impassioned case that people should vote for Joe Biden rather than for Donald Trump. But I think to then say, look, because the danger is not equal on both sides, we shouldn't ever criticize our own side, or we should be very, very careful about calling out bad things on our own side, is just a recipe for making sure that the worst kinds of people will be able to take on, to take over on our own side, that we will not be able to isolate and combat the bad instincts that exist, you know, in politics always. And this sort of splitting of hairs about Antifa, I think, is a great example of this. So it is true that there is not, you know, a national association that coordinates Antifa, that it is not a legal entity in that kind of way. But this, of course, is true of violent political movements of all kinds. It is true of many of the far-right political extremist movements that people are rightly worried about and rightly more worried about. It's even true of organizations like Al-Qaeda. So the same people who claim that Antifa is not really an organization, because look, we don't have some kind of legal charter, don't have nearly the same compunctions to talk about the real existence of other organizations that have a very, very similar nature. So what Antifa is a set of activists who are absolutely coordinated and linked, who basically say, number one, we don't live in a real democracy, so we should be able and willing to use political violence to achieve our ends and to defend against fascism. And B, you know, local groups can decide for themselves who and what is fascist. And what it adds up to is basically a recipe for saying, you know, whichever 20 most radical people, whichever 20 people most willing or keen to use political violence in any one locality, can decide that the local judge or the local mayor or the local elected official is a fascist, and they are now justified in going to violent ends in order to protest those. That is, I think, a very, very dangerous set of ideas, and we should we can absolutely be clear about how misguided that is and how dangerous that is, without therefore claiming or pretending that Antifa is as big of a danger as people on the right with real political power.
So that's a very good answer. As I said, I agree more than I disagree. Even as the kind of sorting out goes on that you describe in that article, so the Ben Shapiro types kind of peel off and say, no, you know what, this is a good time to vote for Trump, and you explain why it's not. There's another kind of really interesting sorting out going on over on the Democratic and left side. There's a pretty interesting article in USA Today today about a movement called Settle for Biden, organized by sort of college-aged Democrats, people who probably were Sanders or Warren Democrats, and Settle for Biden sounds like a joke or damning with faint praise, but they kind of apparently are successfully getting people to see why that is the thing that they should do. Because there's the oddity, right? On the one hand, you know, you could make the argument, as you did, that there are ways in which the Democratic side and the left might be overplaying their hand, might be turning people off a little bit. On the other hand, the people who actually occupy the left regard this as this huge compromise that they have to make against the things that they wanted the most, the things that Sanders or Warren would have delivered. And one of the interesting things to watch in between now and Election Day is, to what degree can they put that whole thing together so that everybody agrees that they have a common cause? I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
Yeah, look, I mean, America is a strange place because it is incredibly diverse, complicated country with people with, you know, all kinds of political views. And yet we have an electoral system which essentially ends up forcing a choice between two candidates. And even if the difference between Joe Biden and Donald Trump is vast and obvious for everyone to see, whatever your feelings about which a better candidate is might be, the people who will have to vote for Joe Biden if he is to win still have huge disagreements amongst each other. And so I think that, I'm very grateful to the people who are perhaps to my left, who realize the importance of voting for Joe Biden, even if he was not the preferred candidate. And I think actions like Settle for Biden are, a good tongue-in-cheek and hopefully effective way of getting people to see that in politics, the perfect is always the enemy of the good. To refuse to vote for Joe Biden because you would have liked a candidate who's further to the left is an even more irresponsible political action than to vote for, as much an irresponsible political action, not more so, than to say that somehow voting for Donald Trump is going to help defeat liberalism. But I do want to sort of push back perhaps a little bit in one way, which is that we've always had this tendency, and by we, I guess I mean pundits and election observers, to cast Joe Biden as this sort of second or third choice. There's something sort of strange about how he became the Democratic nominee, and that, really perhaps most people would have preferred a different candidate. But Joe Biden won by far and away the most votes in the Democratic primary. And I think that is for a reason. It's because actually, while there are, of course, people who would have much preferred a candidate to his left, there's lots and lots of Americans to whom his view of the country really spoke, who say, we do want a candidate who is emphasizing what we have in common rather than what divides us. Who wants real change for America and real improvements, but who doesn't think that we need to call in question the very foundations of the country. Somebody who stands for progressive values, but who also has real respect and sympathy towards conservatives. And so, yes, there are people, as there are in every election, who are going to vote for the Democratic candidate, or for that matter, the Republican candidate, while holding the nose a little bit and thinking, really I would have preferred somebody who speaks to me more directly. I think there's many more people who we don't talk about enough, who are going to go to the polls with great enthusiasm, because Joe Biden actually has a vision of a country that corresponds to how they feel.
I think that that's true. And also, so we've been reading a lot of persuasion articles to get ready for this. And one of the pieces that we read had to do with how extremism or even just extreme beliefs lead to simplism, to simplistic solutions. And so the example cited in the article was build that wall. But I mean, you can look over on the other side and say, you know, defund the police. The people who really meant that, particularly at the most heated period of this past summer's unrest, they really meant it. I mean, I talked to a lot of people who said, oh, no, this isn't some kind of metaphor about dialing something down. We really do mean there's really no reason to have police. Well, that to me, that is a simplistic solution that falls into that category. And I think we're also seeing it in the judicial branch right now, whether it's the simplistic solution that Mitch McConnell has, which is just to make one rule and then break it and load the court up with who he wants, and two, packing the court on the other side seems also, I mean, or at least adding seats willy-nilly to the court seems also like a simplistic solution. You see, to your point, Yasha, Biden trying to be a little bit less of the simplistic person. I mean, I know I'm going to set up a commission is sort of one of the more weaselly things you can say if you want to get out of a dilemma. But it's also a more grown up thing than saying, oh, yeah, well, we're going to add two more justices. So what are you going to do about it? And I think we are at that point. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, countries have a kind of rhythm of their own. And when they have been, you know, reasonably well governed for a while, when it feels like things are relatively calm and perhaps not too many things are at risk, voters sometimes get a little bit antsy and a little bit bored. And they say, you know what, I kind of would like somebody to stir the pot a little bit. I kind of want somebody who just shakes all of this stuff up a little bit, and perhaps something good will come out of that. And I think the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was more about that than we realize and recognize. But often what then happens is that people start to remember and learn how much damage a candidate who just wants to stir things up can do. And I think especially over this past year, with the White House's really inept handling of the pandemic, which is now resurging, you know, people have learned and remembered how big a price they've paid for this simplism, as Ned Rackman put in our piece in Persuasion. So they then often, I think, go back to saying, you know what, perhaps we need a politician who's not making sort of vast promises, who's not quite as entertaining, who's not quite as visceral, but who actually has experience of governing, and who's honest in what they tell the country about what they can and can't do, and who's going to work away, you know, perhaps in a less exciting register, perhaps in a more workaday mode, to actually, you know, get things back to normal and solve some of the problems we have. And you know, politics is the slow boring of hard boards, as Max Weber said in the early 20th century. You know, it's tempting to run away from that insight as a voter and say, I don't want it to be that. I want there to be easy solutions. But I think when you have a lot of exposure to politicians who don't recognize that insight, thankfully many people remember how bad that can end. And that's the reason why I think Joe Biden is the right person for this moment. And that's why current polls seem to indicate, and of course they've been wrong in the past, but they seem strongly to indicate that Joe Biden will win quite convincingly next week.
Right. And let's go back to Weber and let's exploit the double entendre of boring. Because, I mean, yes, you used the word excitement. And one of the things that has happened over the last cycle is that the electorate turned to the presidency and to government as a source of excitement. And I think there's an exhaustion that's settling in here. Yeah. I think people are beginning to realize that having a really exciting government is exhausting. Having a boring government probably means the government's functioning pretty well. There just isn't a whole lot to talk about. I mean, Obama was, by comparison, a very boring president, which could have been seen as a strike against him. I think for a lot of people now, that's a huge plus. Bore me. Make me not think about you for days at a time. If I'm thinking every single day about what the president's doing, that's wrong and it's exhausting. And I'm not really being in any way successfully governed if that's happening. Yasha.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, I mean, a couple of years ago, I told the New York Times, I think that the person who's going to win in 2020 is the candidate who can credibly promise people that if they go out to a bar on a Monday night, they can talk about football rather than politics. Now, as it turns out, nobody can go to bars right now, or few people can, and it's kind of complicated. But other than that, I think that was very prescient. I think that turns out to be right, that you know, most Americans are not that obsessed with politics, and they certainly don't want the politics to be so divisive that you know it starts to complicate the personal relationships in their family, in their neighborhood, with their friends. They don't want to wake up and think, oh my God, I wonder what the president tweeted today. They want to, you know, wake up and check the sports news or the entertainment news or ring their friend for a chat. And so I think part of Joe Biden's appeal is that people know they're not going to have to wake up wondering what he said on Twitter. They're not going to have huge blazing rows about what Joe Biden did or said yesterday in the workplace. That's how most Americans preferred. And I think Joe Biden is the person who sort of recognized that better than certainly either Donald Trump, or for that matter, you know, his competitors in the Democratic primaries.
So, Betsy Kaplan says, I can ask you one more question here. So, this sort of has to do with the kind of health of the surrounding democratic institutions that underpin public life in America, particularly in the following scenario. I mean, we could have a long conversation about what would happen if President Trump were to win a second term, but let's not do that. Let's imagine that, as the polls suggest.
I'd like to be able to sleep soundly tonight.
So that's right. Well, this isn't going to help you sleep any better. Maybe you can help me sleep better, but imagine a scenario where Biden wins. Well, Trump is still president for more than 2.5 months after that, and we'll still be having a pandemic. There'll still be a rollout, to connect us to the next segment we're going to do with Carl Zimmer, a rollout of a vaccine program. There'll be a lot of things happening. And he'll still be president, and he may be even less committed to the normative structure of American governance than he is now, if that's possible. And I'm just sort of wondering what you think about that. I mean, one sort of Yasha Munk-like argument, I would think anyway, would be, yes, but there'll be an awful lot of other surrounding institutions, whether it's the leadership of the military or the courts or whatever, that will in some ways maybe feel a little bit more empowered to stand up to him if he wants to do something ruthless or crazy. But what are your thoughts about that?
So, you know, as you know, I was one of the first people to argue that this rising authoritarian populism around the world, including in the United States with Donald Trump, really does pose a danger to democracy and to democratic institutions. And, you know, I was very worried for the last years about the dramatic stress test over democratic institutions, which has come from the White House. And I think people have now realized and internalized that this argument is not spurious, but there is serious things to worry about here. The one thing that's become evident over the last 4 years, though, is, you know, in many ways, in very, very painful ways, when you think about the pandemic, for example, is that, you know, Donald Trump has a killer instinct for how to dominate the headlines for the next day, but he doesn't seem to spend a whole lot of time thinking about what's going to happen next month or next year. You know, sort of long-term planning of really complicated processes does not appear to be his forte. Now, when I look at authoritarian populists that have effectively managed to stay in power, even though their popularity has ebbed, they have that kind of discipline and that kind of foresight. They have worked from the moment they got into office at how to capture the institutions in such a way as to be able to perpetuate themselves in power. Donald Trump, thankfully, has not done that. And so while I think it's quite likely that he won't accept the legitimacy of the election, even if he clearly loses, he probably won't do the proverbial middle-of-the-night phone call congratulating his competitor on his election. And all of that would be unprecedented and deeply worrying, deeply concerning. You know, he is likely to try and create all kind of mischief in his last 2 or 3 months in office. But I simply don't think that he has done what he would need to do in order to undermine the institutions to such an extent that he can, for example, stay in office even though he clearly loses the election. So I'm actually less worried at this stage than some of my colleagues and some of my friends about just how nasty these 2 or 3 months are going to be. There will be a lot of nastiness. Donald Trump is once again going to be absolutely irresponsible. But if Biden wins clearly next, nothing will stop him from taking power on January 20th.
All right. With that, we reluctantly end our conversation with Yasha Monk, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of Persuasion, which is also a podcast. And I think a line of condiments may be coming as well. So get everything that has Persuasion on it and listen to the podcast. And yes, contributing editor at The Atlantic. Latest book, The People Versus Democracy, Why Our Freedom is in Danger and How to Save It. Come back soon, Yasha.
I will. Thank you, Carlin.
All right. We'll take a break. We're going to talk to Carl Zimmer. I would say the preeminent science journalist in America. Who's going to argue with me? Ed Yong maybe would argue with me. We'll talk about vaccines and the latest crazy COVID White House news and stuff like that.
The stab and glare and buckshot of the heavy, heavy snow. It comes and goes.
All right, we're back. And pretty much every Monday, we try to give you updates on the medical science surrounding COVID-19 as much as we possibly can, and just the epidemiology as well. Joining us today to do some of that with us is Carl Zimmer, the author of 13 books about science. His next book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive, will be published in 2021. He's a columnist for the New York Times, adjunct professor at Yale. I could go on, but then Carl wouldn't get to talk, and we don't like that. So, Carl, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So before we get to, I mean, first of all, I got to say, you wrote 2 really terrific pieces on vaccine rollouts that had all kinds of things in it that I hadn't thought about or known about. And I really try to think about and know about a lot of this stuff. So I want to come to that in just a second. But, you know, there's an awful lot going on right now, just in the present moment, including on Sunday, when Mark Meadows, the chief of staff, kind of threw everybody a curveball. Who is it? Was it Michael Kinsey who famously said that a gaffe is when a politician accidentally tells the truth? This is how. So, Kat, we're going to go to A1 here. This is how Mark Meadows talked about the current thinking in the White House about the COVID crisis.
We're not going to control the pandemic. We are going to control the fact that we get vaccines, therapeutics, and other mitigation.
Why aren't we going to get control of the pandemic?
Because it is a contagious virus, just like the flu.
Yeah, but why not make efforts to contain it?
Well, we are making efforts to contain it.
By running all over the country, not wearing a mask?
Jake,
that's what the vice president's doing.
We can get into the back and forth. Let me just say this. Is what we need to do is make sure that we have the proper mitigation factors, whether it's therapies or vaccines or treatments, to make sure that people don't die from this. But to suggest that we're going to actually quarantine all of America, lock down our economy.
No one's saying that.
Well, that they are.
All right. Well, since then, Meadows kind of doubled down on that a little bit. The president today, I think, kind of came back against it a little bit and said, well, no, he's still committed to containment and mitigation. I mean, not in any way that you could really point to, but at least superficially. But, you know, so, Carl, which was this? In some ways, it seemed like maybe Meadows was telling the truth for the first time, that, you know, there really doesn't seem to be much commitment to that. And as Tapper was pointing out, the vice president now has direct exposures, which don't seem to induce him to quarantine or do much of anything other than what he wants to do. What did you make of that whole stir?
It was concerning because it sounds like our administration is giving up on public health. That's what it sounds like. Maybe they meant something else, but I don't know what we're supposed to make of it otherwise. I mean, it's true that vaccines, when they come, are going to have a huge benefit to how we deal with the pandemic. You know, antivirals and other drugs will keep some people who are infected from dying, but to say like, oh, we can just rely on those is, I mean, if we, there was just a study, for example, that just came out that showed that through the end of the year, if there's aggressive masking, you know, if we all mask up, we could save 130,000 lives. We're not going to have vaccines by then. Antivirals will, and, you know, monoclonal antibodies will not be ready to save everybody by then. It's just, we have to take public health seriously, or literally hundreds of thousands of people are going to die. I don't know how more simply I can put it.
Yeah, and I think it also, there's a tendency, I think, particularly because people see the death per case rate going down, to think, oh, well, we must have sort of really lassoed this thing. But from what I can tell, and there was a big journal study somewhere that came out within the last week. I heard Daniel Griffin talking about it on Twitter, saying that really, if you look at the therapeutics that's out there right now, none of them work that great. You know, they work kind of situationally. They might not knock a hospital day down from 15 days to 10 or something like that. But there isn't a great therapeutic out there. Probably what there is increasing skill among clinicians to kind of identify what kind of problem is being had right now, how to address it, where to put this person, whether this person needs proning or ventilation. That, you know, our clinicians are getting smarter about treating it, but there is no magic pill right now for anybody to take therapeutically, and it's, I think, kind of dangerous for Meadows to suggest that's sitting out there, you know, on the doorstep, just a few weeks or something away. But that seemed to be a little bit a part of the message, Carl.
Well, we have one drug that's approved for COVID-19, remdesivir. So that's approved. And that just got formally approved just a few days ago. It's great to have a drug that's approved. But, you know, you have to look at it carefully. It's not it's not a panacea. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence that remdesivir reduces mortality, for example. Mm-hmm. The evidence, such as it is, suggests that it could reduce people's stay in the hospital. At least that was from a couple clinical trials. There was a much bigger trial the World Health Organization put forward, which was actually, you know, not very encouraging. The results were even smaller. So yes, remdesivir helps. Probably, as you say, what's really helping is that doctors are just getting to know this disease better and using lots of things in their arsenal. Like you mentioned, proning, just flipping people over onto their chests, who, you know, turns out that's very helpful. Anticoagulants are probably helpful when you figure out when's the best way to use them. So a lot of that's coming forward. And there will be new drugs that are going to be put into use. Monoclonal antibodies, they are coming. Now, just how effective they will be, can't say until we actually see the data from these trials. There are other drugs that are pumping along in the clinical trials as well. I helped to run a treatment tracker at the New York Times, and it's a lot of work because there's a lot of research going on. But you cannot count on that to say like, oh, well, everyone's going to be fine starting tomorrow. It's just that it takes time to get these things through the clinical trials, get them approved. And then there's the manufacturing, you know. I mean, Regeneron made a big deal about, you know, the first several hundred thousand doses that they were going to provide were going to be free of charge to patients in the United States. That might not last very long when you've got like 400,000 people in the hospital right now, and it's only going to shoot up this fall. You could run through that supply very quickly. So just getting enough of these drugs is going to be a huge demand too.
Right. Oh yeah. In terms of demand too, what you're saying, I mean, there's the kind of scary triaging starting to go on in hospitals in some of the hotspot states. They are essentially having to say to patients, well, you know, we can't kind of help you the way maybe we would ordinarily be able to. So we're already kind of in that area. I want to leave a lot of time here, starting now, to talk about vaccines, because you've done so much really interesting reporting about it. And let's sort of begin with the question of, you know, what would have been the best way to go about all this. And there's a case that gets made that, you know, what you would really like to do, particularly if you're going to try to figure out which is the best vaccine, the most efficacious vaccine, the safest vaccine, the vaccine that's maybe able to confer both protective and sterilizing immunity, you know, that really would make a certain amount of sense to kind of test them all side by side, or as many of them as you could, as opposed to allowing each company to develop its own trial pattern, pace, and methodology, although hewing, of course, to some existing standards. So can you say a little bit more about that and what's been experimented with? There are some places outside the U.S. where, as I understand it, that kind of side-by-side testing might be happening.
So we're in an unprecedented moment in medical history where, first of all, we're dealing with a global pandemic. Second of all, a whole bunch of research teams have been pushing out vaccines to be tested at a record rate. So we have the situation where actually we have a whole lot of vaccines that are potentially could be tried out. And so the question is, like, as they are getting ready for clinical trials, do you test them one at a time against placebos, or do you maybe combine them into a sort of a mega trial? You know, in my reporting, when speaking to Tony Fauci and others, it became clear that early on, he and others were arguing in favor of taking a bunch of these vaccines and testing them all against the same placebo group under the same conditions in the same place at the same time, and then being able to compare them against each other, to not just say like, oh, this one's good, but to say, well, this one's good, but this one's better. Or maybe this one's better in this subpopulation, where you could have direct comparisons. We didn't go that way. So instead, what has happened is that there have been independent clinical trials. There's a little bit of, there's some coordination, I should say, between them, some of them. So that's going to be good in terms of like doing some studies across vaccines at the National Institutes of Health. But it's not what people had really been hoping for. And it turns out the World Health Organization is about to start just that kind of a master trial, probably within the next few weeks in Latin America. That's going to really tell you a lot about not just whether individual vaccines work, but which ones are the best, you know. And we're supporting this with billions of dollars of taxpayer money. So yeah, we ought to be getting our money's worth. We would like to know, well, which vaccine is best? And, you know, what happens if the first one that gets authorized by the FDA is not the best? Well, what then? It's going to be, could be potentially challenging for that next vaccine to prove its mettle, because you're going to be comparing it not against a placebo, potentially, but against that first vaccine. And that's a totally different kind of trial.
And to help people understand, you know, why some of this is important, too, I mean, vaccine trials, for the most part, although there's a British trial, I guess, now, where they're going to do what they call challenge exposure. In other words, they are going to take participants, subjects, all of them kind of on the young side, and actually intentionally expose them to the virus. But that's not typically how vaccines are tried out. They're tried out by chance exposure. But the problem is, you know, if you get the Moderna people wandering around having chance exposure in environments A, B, and C, and the Pfizer people wandering around and having the same chance exposure in environments D, E, and F, and so on, you know, that's one of the areas where it's almost impossible, I would think, to know which one's working better, at least in terms of the protective immunity part.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of vaccine experts are concerned about how we're going to coordinate all these vaccines coming out, because the United States government has said explicitly that, you know, they want to have enough doses for every American by April or May, which is a laudable goal, but it's not, no one company, Pfizer, for example, is not going to be able to meet that need. It's a huge manufacturing challenge. So you're going to actually really have to hope that several different vaccines get authorized. But then you got to like decide like, okay, well, how do we decide who gets what? And there are committees like at the Centers for Disease Control who that's what they do. But you know, I've talked to people on that committee and they're like, well, we're not going to be able to make really good comparisons between them because of the way that these trials are set up. So it's going to be a challenge.
All right, so we're going to take a break. When we come back, Carl's going to tell us what happened inside the federal government. There actually was one office that was pretty good at this kind of thing. We're going to find out what happened to it and some other stuff when we get back.
Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets.
All right, before we get back to Carl Zimmer, let me say some thank yous. So great. Not that she wasn't admirably and ably substituted for last week, but great to have Kat Pastor back in the saddle. She's the one who's running things at the studio for us, and that means that Betsy Kaplan, senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show and producer of this episode, can work from home, as can I. And let's see. So tomorrow we're going to re-air a show that we did about pods, about how kind of the sort of default design of the last 10 or 15 years may be the pod, and what that means and how it shows up in lots of different places. I know that sounds kind of weird. And I think we have a horror show coming up later this week and a cord packing show. We got all kinds of fun. Maybe the horror show and the cord packing show are the same one. I don't know. That could be. Joining us right now is Carl Zimmer, the author of 13 books, writes for the New York Times, adjunct professor of Yale. His next book is Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive. The minute the show ends, you should call RJ Julia and pre-order that. Don't get it from Amazon. Get it from an independent bookseller. But get it. And Carl has been writing a lot about the rollout of vaccines, what is going to happen in this unprecedentedly chaotic environment where you've got, you know, eight or so vaccines maybe coming into the market at close to the same time. And then this huge cohort of other ones that could conceivably come onto the market. How do we track it? How do we understand what's happening? It gets out in the general population. Things start happening. People start to have heart attacks and strokes because people are going to have heart attacks and strokes no matter what. So how do we know if the vaccine caused any of them? A million, billion, zillion different questions like that. And to top things off, Carl, you report to us that the office that kind of would have taken charge of a lot of this stuff has been merged into something else. It's not exactly intact anymore.
That's right. I mean, we've had one experience that even approaches what we're about to go through now. And that happened in 2009 when the H1N1 flu strain arose and there was a pandemic and the government scrambled to create a new vaccine. 82 million people got the vaccine over the course of a few months. And then there had to be a huge effort to track people to see whether there were any incredibly rare side effects that hadn't been picked up in clinical trials, and to be able to get that information out quickly so that people could have confidence that the vaccine was safe. Because as you say, people every day have strokes and heart attacks and even much rarer things happen. And if somebody sort of sees a cluster of those things happening at once and then says, well, that happened within a few days of me getting a vaccine, it must have been the vaccine, suddenly you can have people getting really scared about vaccines that could in fact save their life. And you don't want that. So what happened in 2009 was that there was a government-wide effort, and it was coordinated in large part through what's known as the National Vaccine Program Office. And so, you know, I talked with people who had run that and what sort of lessons they had. And so they mentioned along the line, like, well, you know, there isn't a National Vaccine Program Office anymore. So we're concerned that there isn't that kind of leadership happening. And it turned out that last year, the National Vaccine Program Office, you know, as an independent office, no longer exists. It was folded into another office. So it's now called the Office of Infectious Disease Policy and HIV/AIDS. You know, and they still do some vaccine work in terms of like long-term strategy planning. There's a committee there. But a lot of the experts, you know, are no longer connected with it, who were involved in the previous effort. And so not only is that office not, you know, no longer an independent office anymore, but there doesn't seem to be from the experts I talked to, any real leadership in getting ready for this incredibly important challenge of tracking what happens when you give vaccines to hundreds of millions of people.
Right. There is something called the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee, VRB PAC.
They're not going to handle this. They're not going to do that. That's not their job. So the Center for Disease Control does have some programs in place. They are going to be tracking, for example, like the healthcare workers who are probably going to get the vaccines first. They've invented a smartphone app that will be where they'll be able to check in with people who get vaccinated every day and say, how you doing? You got anything going on? And then if there's anything wrong, they'll get a call. They will actually be following up very carefully with them. That's important, but that's not enough for, you know, tracking over the course of a few months as potentially, you know, 100 million, 200 million people get vaccinated, 300 million. Like, I hope everyone gets vaccinated, but you need much better, bigger systems that are centrally organized, and you need systems in place to communicate that out to the public reliably, transparently, dispassionately, because just think about it. Like in 2009, we did not have Russian disinformation agents spreading anti-vaccine nonsense. We have that now. We already have it. So just imagine what spring's going to be like.
Oh, yeah. No, that's I actually think that what's going to happen is that the importance of you and people like you, you and Helen Branswell and Ed Yong and people like that is going to be even greater in terms of informing the public about what's going on. I think also one of your colleagues at the Times wrote about something called the Vaccine Confidence Project in London, run by an anthropologist named Heidi Larson, that, you know, there's going to be government's not going to be able to do this also because of things related to my previous conversation with Yasha Munk, government isn't even as trusted, even if it were functioning at peak levels, even if they hadn't, merged things and gotten rid of things. Our relationship to government, I think, is somewhat different from what it was in 2009 or before that. And you sort of wonder who people will trust on a large enough basis so that there can be some kind of uniformity of purpose about all this, and 300 million people could get vaccinated. But I almost feel like it may have to come from other sources. You don't want that responsibility.
We'll do our best, but you know, the United States government has more resources, you know, and could put, if it really put its mind to it, could really make a crucial difference. We're not going to get the pandemic behind us in any sort of long-term way unless the majority of people by far get vaccinated. It just has to happen. Otherwise, we're going to be just looking at these cases, thousands and thousands of cases, just day after day after day. I hope this vaccine rollout goes swimmingly, and I hope everybody gets a vaccine and feels confident about it. The government has to play a role.
Oh, yeah. No. And the CDC would seem to have a carrying capacity in the FDA. Well, let's hope that they can do it. We have to stop there. Carl Zimmer is the author of 13 books about science. His next book, Life's Edge, The Search for What It Means to Be Alive, will be published in 2021. We thank him for taking time to join us today. We thank you for listening. And we thank the people behind me, Kat Pastor, Betsy Kaplan, and the rest of the gang for making it all work, because God knows I have no idea what's going on anymore. So I really need more help than ever. All right. Thanks for listening today. We'll be back tomorrow with Pods.